Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we are stone, the immaculate. Now listen to this, I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopelessness, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
How about a little of this?
A faded sign at the side of the road that says 15 miles to the
with that. Welcome to Summertime. You know, every week I try to record these little songs and play them on the air, and they come out like they're a tin can. I'm your host, Dr. Mark. This is Summertime. Number to call to participate in the shoe is 646-478-4847. It's your hour. I'm here. I got information. I got all kinds of fancy things to say, but for the most part, it's up to you to make this show come alive! Alive! Unbelievable. Well, here we go. Now, we're going to jump right into a little Soma casting here. We're going to sneak in on Fox as it's doing a little Rush Limbaugh review as his bid to take over the Rams as a minority owner was denied.
A group that wanted to buy an NFL...
The Hannity Show, a fascinating human study.
Quite possibly. You think so? Quite possibly. You think so?
No. It's a part of double standard. You know, what offends me about this whole thing, this political posturing, is the racial buffoonery. It's the race baiting. It's the racial hustling. It's the constant finding a racist behind every rock. We see white people all over, and every time. Everybody's a racist. And we have these instant experts on who's a racist, like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, who, by the way, embraced the real racist, Louis Farrakhan. But nobody ever talks about that, because that was a real black racist and an anti-Semite to boot. But they're the experts.
Radical. And eco is all gaga.
To shout and scream about
Michael Myers. Not the Halloween guy.
Correct. You have a valid point, but at the same time, let's keep in mind that Rush Limbaugh does have 13 to 20 million listeners a day, 15 hours a week. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton don't have that. That's all.
Oh, wait, he's agreeing with
him. Screaming A. Smith.
Both have, I find this amazing, you think of antelopers.
You're keeping score at home. Hannity being the Philo, Screaming A, the Onto, and Michael Myers coming in from downtown, bringing on the eco thunder. Now we're chilling.
Talent of the players on the field.
Allow me to play the role of
going to jump in here. This is absolutely fascinating. If you're late to the show or simulcasting the Hannity show here on Fox, because they're discussing this Rush Limbaugh bid to be a minority owner, which was struck down with righteous anger the last couple of days. And we got Stephen A. here and this other guy just absolutely just batting this around like a badminton bunny. Funny. Birdie. All right. Thank you, man. Thank you for all the insight. Welcome to Selma Time again. I had to jump in and do that because the Rush thing really kind of stood out as one of those little juicy side stories as we row the boat this week. There's so much going on. We got the swine flu. Oh, we got to get that in before the guest comes on.
King Kong ain't got shit on me!
Yeah, okay. That's I had to get that in because the swine flu is getting powerful. And we had a whole hour on that last week on the whole vaccine thing. And now New York State, which is becoming the lead dog. As you can tell, I'm a little nasal this week. Yep. Kind of spent my vocal cords at the Springsteen concert last Thursday, and my body's in full repair. I must run for a shot. Or, well, one thing I won't be doing is playing any beer pong, because officials at Upstate New York College saying students are sharing cups during a drinking game called beer pong became infected with the swine flu. H1N1! Medical officials at RPI, a bunch of geeks up in Troy. I'm at the school, University of Albany. The geeks were playing beer pong, and they were sharing cups, and the health director wrote a letter to the students saying, no, 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 there will be no more of this type of socializing on this campus. So the RPI is full of H1N1, so there's no more beer pong. Get all those letters right? 21 cases of swine flu at RPI, including 7 who are in isolation rooms. What are they doing? And so they're going to be offering those vaccines in a couple weeks. Again, the fear and mongering here. We are on October 14th, and the vaccines have not really hit the streets in full force. That'll be coming soon. The sniffy sniff ones went out last week, and the other one that for the seasonal came out, and the study came out again that a lot of people that got the seasonal shot became more likely to get the real swine. And this is a swine-free show, so we're trying to get you out of this constant fear-mongering. Every organism at this time of the year in this part of the globe is going through a little bit of a garage sale, okay? Just like the leaves are falling from the trees. If you buy my lousy cheap program, Morning Woo, over at somaspace.org, click on the Morning Woo thing, you'll see it there, for less than $20, me and my partner in crime over there on the West Coast, William Whitman, give you a strategy to take you through the entire autumn vitalistically, holistically, and with lots of glee. Right? We were playing the Love Shack there before. Trying to, anyway. But we can't do that here. We have to deal with all kinds of mishmagosh. So people lose touch with their surroundings, lose touch with their rhythms, and they succumb to the pressure of the big pharma. So that's what's happening. As I take a cough break, let me just, I have a canned cough. There you go.
All right, that's it. He's fired.
Yeah.
Can I talk to you, Val?
No,
yes,
okay. Please.
I'm back. No beer pong. All right. There we go. Without further ado, I see he has found his way up here to summertime. Uh-oh. The whole thing just went bazooey on me. We'll get the submarine going. And welcome to the program. We have Steve Sisko from OneDream.com. He's got a great new book out. We're going to be talking about it here, getting you guys a little oriented toward what's something called BQ, your body intelligence. Welcome to Summertime, Steve.
Great to be on your show. You got a wild show going there.
Yeah, we got lots of things. We got Rush Limbaugh going on. We got all kinds of things going on out here because, basically we're in the middle of the week. People are standing there with their hands on their hips and, you know, they're not quite ready to throw their arms up and say FNAB yet, but we're trying to get them to roll up their sleeves and dig into themselves a little bit and not succumb to all the lot of, relentless pressure from the outside to do certain behaviors. And we just were talking about the beer pong situation in RPI, where they can't play beer pong anymore because, I don't know, 7 kids got sick. So no more fun for you. So now you got to go take your beer pong and like it's prohibition up there in Troy, New York. So welcome to the program. We got lots of news on the somatic front here to sort of wade through. First thing I want to do is give us your 30-40 second sort of summary of what it is that book. If someone picked up this book in the airport tomorrow and they're flying across the country, they're going to read it when they get to the other side. What are they picking up in your book? What's the idea they're going to pop out of the plane with?
Actually, if someone picks up that book, by the time they get off the plane, they'll realize that their body is their ally. They actually have an amazing amount of wisdom. It's their personal Google. And if they take and learn from that book, really simply, they're going to get inspired, but they're also going to learn techniques that they can get more in touch with their whole body consciousness real quickly. In other words, if they're driving in a car, rather than gripping the wheel and gritting their teeth and getting a headache and not knowing it, after this book, they'll be more aware. They'll be taking a breath and they'll notice they're gripping the wheel and they'll relax.
Yeah, and this is a big thing because as we move into the fall, you've got a lot of people that basically operate an automatic pilot. I call it the holiday hijinks. And they go through a lot of sort of scripts, rehearsals, where, you know, I'll even just something as mild as Halloween coming up. That creates a lot of tension in households. There's a lot of, especially this year, things going on. And people aren't conscious of how many things that they're burying in their body, and then they think it's from some other cause. So the disconnect goes on. You talk about something called SET that you do to prepare yourself, and this is a self-evident truth SET, that people can actually become, you know, much more in touch with this intelligence. Talking about. So we'll break it down kind of back to front here. First, give us a working definition of BQ so people can understand what that concept's about just on the surface, then we'll kind of dive deep.
Sure. Well, your BQ, you know what your IQ is. Your IQ is your mental smarts. You know, gee, I know all these facts and figures, and I'm really good at Trivial Pursuit, and I can beat my friend on Jeopardy and all that good stuff. That's great. And then the BQ would actually be your body intelligence, meaning you have an awareness. Like I said earlier, you'll know if you're gripping the wheel. You have an awareness that when you talk to someone and you have a conversation, you'll say, wow, I noticed while I was talking to my boss or my lover, I was tightening my belly. Let me see what that's about. So like you said, they won't miss the boat. It won't be like walking time bombs, not knowing that they're building stress. You know, even Halloween, people can be all day building stress in their body, like you said, and not realizing it. Then one thing goes up at night to get them a little upset, and they're yelling and screaming, and everybody's looking at them like, well, what? Jeez, huh? So it wasn't in that moment. It's the buildup, because our body's always there. Even though our mind tries to get away from it, our body feels and knows everything. It's been there from day one.
Yeah, and again, people pay $10 to go to the movie to see this paranormal activity, to be frightened out of their shoes. And it's a state-chasing phenomenon where we're so out of touch with our bodies that we'll become stimulus-dependent, I call it, where we need to have that sensory overload almost to get our body to kind of wake up and engage, because we've sort of numbed ourselves to the everyday sensations like you're talking about that are part of the background noise that is our affect, that is our inner world. And I think for the most part, I don't remember learning any of that in gym class. Everything in gym class was motor. Just keep moving around, you know, and basically it was much more of a peripheral awareness, where you're talking much more of a central and internal awareness that it's almost like as if when you went to the educator in gym back then, it was much more about games, much more about external, much more about group. And this is a different discipline altogether, which is sadly, unless you're in one of the extreme school systems around here, you don't get much of this. You have to go to some ashram or some, you know, retreat house. And, oh, I didn't mention about that, the whole thing with the sweat lodge. Maybe we'll get into that the last weekend. So what is it about this type of awareness that is so difficult to get people to consistently apply?
Well, first of all, let's start early. So you're small and you're hot. You're in a room and you're like, oh, mommy, I'm so hot. I need to take my sweater off. You're not hot. It's not hot in here. What kind of message is that? That message is, hey, maybe I don't know what I feel. I thought I was hot, but she's my mom. She says it's not hot in here. What's wrong with me? Then things become uncomfortable. For instance, something happens that shames you or traumatizes you or hurts you. You're embarrassed. What we usually do is we hold our breath, and then we enroll our body. We hold tight, and we enroll our body to hold on to what we can't express, like, no, but I don't want that, or no, that's wrong, or I need that. Instead of being able to express our needs out, we enroll to hold it in our body because we either get punished or hurt, or somebody would tell us we were wrong. So it's a combination of what our coaches and parents told us, and then we started to believe it, and it became a pattern. I call it spin indoctrination. We've been spun and indoctrinated to not feel.
And because of that, again, one of the things that happens early on is that we learn to link those kinds of, I call them loco patterns, low coherence patterns, with medication, with attention, with, you know, isolation even. Because when you feel pain, when you feel fatigue, when you feel, you know, you feel out of sorts, or you're emotionally not stable, the tendency in the culture is to isolate you. The tendency in the culture is to remove you from this. And so we never learn how to deal with that stuff, and so we learn how to basically try to suppress it or push it away, and it keeps coming back, you know, in other funky ways, and we develop sort of coping mechanisms to kind of ward these things off, and it could disturb things like sleep and all kinds of other fun, you know, biological functions. So when you're saying body intelligence, this is not something that we have to learn. This is something we need to allow ourselves to experience. So just give us, we're going through the end of this this quarter here, beginning of the fourth quarter now. I've got a lot of these people that work on the tip of Manhattan coming up the train here, and they don't look good. I mean, they look like they've been through a whirlwind pretty much. What is it about the accumulation of these body signals that sort of overloads us to the point where interpreting them becomes secondary to just simply acknowledging them? How do we get people to just, it's almost like an arm wrestling match, to just cry uncle here and say, okay, I want to learn how to deal with this because I don't want to depend on the drugs. I don't want to depend on the interventions. I want to do this myself.
Well, first of all, I think, unfortunately, many people need a wake-up call, need an accident, need bad news from the doctor, need someone to leave them after a 10-year relationship. Unfortunately, will require some kind of wake-up call or shock to get them to go, wow. Other than that, yeah, you're right. Most people are numb, and let's face it, and I'm not judging anybody. Who wants to be uncomfortable? You're a little kid, and something hurts, and you're told not to cry, and you're told to eat a candy or do this pill or do that and make it go away. Then you watch TV as you get older, and it's telling you, you know, you have a backache, take a pill. You have this, take that. So no one wants to be uncomfortable. The problem is that with that discomfort, it's what we've been taught and educated to do with it. And then on top of that, it makes other people uncomfortable. If I tell my truth, maybe my coach, my mother, my teacher doesn't really feel comfortable with what my truth is. And then as a result, they get upset. So then I get a lesson that says, better not tell my truth. Oh, truth equals I'm going to get embarrassed, or somebody's going to try to hurt me, or somebody's going to tell me I'm wrong. So it's a combination, you know, from childhood up to those messages. And no, you're right. As a culture, that's pretty much how it is. Plus, we're all on computers, and we're looking at screens out there. I had a friend took his kids to the beach, and when they got to the beach, the kid says, hey, we want to stay in the van. We'll play with our computer-held Game Boys. Think about it.
Yeah, like I said, we've done that with just about every aspect of life, because even just as something, you know, you've seen it happen in the military, where we've made even the act of war into video games and to dehumanize, disassociate, and somehow, again, to sort of cut off this communication between brain and body so that we don't have to deal with this. And then when we do, of course, it is a crisis. It is something that's coming up, you know, out of nowhere. Oh, out of nowhere. But no, you've been pushing this down for 35, 40 years, and now your body says, I need to get this signal through whether you want to hear it or not. And instead of having cooperation in your system, you have this internal conflict that builds up. And you talk about it in your book about how people can deal with this from a standpoint of, is it memory? Is it something that's coming up in the past? Like you talked about before, where the mother's telling you, no, this is not, almost directing your experience or directing the interpretation of your experience. So you have to go into self-denial, give up your truth, give up that little, I call it truth decay, where you have that territorial loss where that part of you gets taken away. And, In semantics, the phrase that pays is first-person authority. We're trying to get people to go back to first-person awareness. We're sort of conditioned to think third-person, where it's me and my bad knee. Like this time of the year, people are transitioning from the golfing and the tennis into the skiing and stuff. You know, so it's like different muscle groups, and they'll go out and you know, in a month or two, and they'll try and get their legs for skiing. Like, oh, my legs aren't there. Well, you haven't used them in 6-7 months, so you have to go back and re-engage them. And this process of sort of having a conversation with yourself that doesn't require words, it requires this patience and this almost kind of self-parenting. I just see a lot of people becoming very impatient with that. They want instant results. And like you talked about before, where they're not willing to kind of allow themselves to feel. So how do you get people who are trained to, or just kind of conditioned and sort of have a habit of kind of head over heart to slow down and pay attention? You get into a lot of breath work in your private practice, right?
Yes. I actually, the first thing I want to share with who's listening is that I have a process that we can do called a self-evident truth.
Right.
And why I call it that is because it's self-evident. Even though someone else might think outside, you know, I know more than you, or you should be feeling and thinking that, if we really get inside and we have this knowingness in our body, then we can actually say, you know, no matter who outside says something, I actually noticed that my stomach got tight when she was telling me about that. I actually noticed my legs started shaking when my boss gave me that assignment. I'm actually aware of my self-evident truth. Also, SET, self-evident truth, is an easy thing to remember. To get set before you make a presentation. Get set before you go out into the world. Get set before you go out on that first date. In other words, take a moment to really choose to go into your body. And you're right, start with the breath, because the breath is the integrative conversation between the mind and the body. It's the first place to start. And if you just breathe slowly down in your belly, like martial artists and yoga teachers and healthy babies breathe, just notice, what's the quality of my breath? Is it choppy? Is it soft? Am I breathing from my belly or up in my chest? And then do a whole body scan after that. Oh, I didn't notice I was tightening my knee. Oh, I didn't notice that my throat had something to say that I was holding in. And say it out loud, just like I did. And then take action. If you're noticing that you're gripping your leg, relax your leg with the breath. If it needs to shake, let it shake. In other words, let your body do what it organically wants. It will unwind itself, and it will unwind a lot of the stress and anxiety. The mind doesn't know how to separate the fact from the fiction. The body always has the fact.
And again, we're trained to interpret it from a more of a parts model than a holistic model, where we will perceive us and our bad knee, us and our aching ankle, or, you know, and even with emotional problems too, us and our anxiety. We separate ourselves a lot, is what I'm trying to say. And with this set approach, what you're trying to do is and you just said the word organic, which is you know, another little word that kind of slips under the radar, allowing life. The word invitation is something I do a lot with clients. The word invitation means let life in, and that's fundamentally what breath is when you get into the spiritual aspects of it, prana, all that stuff. But for the most part, what I see happening with people, especially now we're a year removed from the big, you know, oh, my God, you know, is that people are striving for stability. They're striving for, you know, a plateau, a place that they can perceive to be safe, and they always look outside for it. And, you know, one of my many bumper stickers over there on the wall is close your eyes and find your feet. Most people aren't aware. Proprioception is something that I guess it went out of style in like the 50s or something, around the hula hoop. Is that, you talking about the kids at the beach before, how do we get people to get back into a spatial awareness of themselves when they're so, in effect, spaced out by the way they live their life? If the lifestyle is so antithetical to this awareness, what's the first step? You talk about breath, talk about acknowledging. But what's the first step to making this the primary way of being in the world as opposed to the ones that they've been trained and internalized?
First step would actually be to make a commitment because, see, like we said earlier, people would wait until something would happen where they'll step off of a curb, and if somebody steps off of a curb unconsciously in a rush, boom, both ankles broken. of course, and after that, she's going to start thinking, wow, I need to be more aware of where I step. So unfortunately, it takes a lot of that. But I feel like many people today are actually learning about the new sciences, somatic sciences. Things are being put under the microscope, and people are going, huh, we do have a memory in the cells. You know, it makes sense. Our body was there from day one. Even though our mind needed to escape because it was uncomfortable, it was embarrassing, it was abusive, our body was there. So as a result, our body gets to take in experiences, and they become memories. What you said earlier about those beliefs and so forth, I call them viral beliefs. It's like a virus that sits in your system. And if you know, we all have viruses, and if we get really stressed or our immune down, we get sick. Well, it's the same thing. I walked into a TV studio. I'm a very confident guy. They said, you're on in 3 minutes, and I started sweating profusely and had anxiety in my whole body. I'm like, whoa, what is going on? Well, fortunately, I have that commitment. So I took a deep breath and started to feel in my body, and I had a memory. I had a memory of, like, when I was 8 years old, I left my neighborhood for the first time and got beat up. I learned early on, uh-oh, don't go too far. It's not safe. Well, now I'm going on national TV. That's very big. That's a very big audience. Somewhere in there, that belief that lives in my body got activated. Fortunately, I'm able to identify it and breathe through it. Mm-hmm. But you can see what I'm talking about. We all have memories where our mind left, but our body still had the memory. Even though our mind left, our body squeezed it in and held the memory. And now they're even proving under the microscope that we do have memory in the cells.
Yeah, this is one of the things that in somatics you get something called somatic recall, where you're doing something as simple as closing your eyes and finding your feet, and if, the longer you linger in there, the more the background conversation will march to the foreground like a parade going by, and you'll get energetic little flashbacks of events, and you'll see all kinds of things happening. And sometimes the practitioner will share in that experience, because the separation between self and other becomes dissolved in that moment. There's a harmony with the heartbeats and the brain. All that science is there. And I just think people are, when they have those things, they go to the weekend seminar. Maybe, I don't know if you're familiar with this whole thing last weekend with the Sweat Lodge, where the people passed away, unfortunately. You know, where they go to such extremes, the fire walk, you know, those kinds of approaches, the rope courses that some of these, you know, corporations take people on these big retreats, and they get into this. They almost go from having absolutely no BQ at all to having this, like, you know, astronaut-level BQ. you know, where they're like Marines, and there's no progression in between. So it becomes a state-chasing thing, and you see it out there in the self-help industry, where people go for some weekend, and they'll basically spend, you know, 36 hours in a controlled environment having this uber experience, you know, this other than usual experience, and they go home, they crash land. And the Tuesday after the workshop, they're like a puddle on the ground, and they can't even butter their toast. So how do you get people to have a rhythm?
I think it's good that people get to have experiences because they want to. You know, I think it's good that people are thinking, I want to do something out of my ordinary experience. I think that's important. However, you know, there should be leaders, supervisors that know not to put people in the heat for a long time, teach people, you know, properly if they're going to do something like a ropes course and so forth. I think a lot of people, you know, are looking for extreme things because at some deep level they do want to feel their body. It's the only way they know how. And that's why my book, What's Your Body Telling You, is telling people to listen. Listen to your body. You don't need to do an extreme sport or jump off out of an airplane. And there's nothing wrong with that. If that's what you want to do, it's great. But you don't need to do that to get in touch with that you have feelings, sensations, emotions, beliefs, and that you have behaviors that are formed as a child. You know, so many of us have body gestures and habits, and I call it your billboard. People don't even know they're making a presentation on health, and they're all hunched over. You know, or they're talking to someone about how relaxed they are, and their hands are, you know, tight, and they're gritting their teeth. So I think it's really important to have more congruence between what is my mind saying and what is my body saying, and are they saying the same message versus the incongruency where one's saying one and the other saying another. That gives a confused message, gets a confused result.
And with both communication being nonverbal, the body is communicating to the other body, and whatever's coming out of the person's mouth is being basically dismissed, as you said, as a mismatch. So the person can be very articulate and very verbal and very, you know, formal with the way they're speaking, but if their body looks like, don't believe a word this guy's saying, it's, politicians are guilty of this all the time, and especially when you see them when they're backpedaling like they've been lately, one after the other, especially this health care bill coming out. Maybe we'll get into that a little bit. I love that scene. I don't know if you saw it last night when they went around the room to have everybody vote. Did you watch that when they voted on the health care bill last night? And everyone had a vote, you know, out loud. It was about 25 of them, I guess, in that finance committee. And they're like, yes, yes. Yeah. And you saw, like, Chuck.
What happened?
Well, you just, I was watching it. They approved it to get it out of the committee. Now it goes into the main Senate thing, and they're going to argue over a whole bunch of other stuff that has nothing to do with health care reform and everything to do with insurance industries and stuff. But the whole point was is that these guys in that committee, you could tell when they were voting if they believed in their vote or they were doing it for some strange, you know, some other objective, some other agenda. So you watch Chuck Schumer, who's the senator from New York, completely, like you said, hunched over like almost like an upside-down letter J. And he's like, yes, you know, totally disgusted. And then a couple of the Republicans on the other side were like, yes, you know. And it was just a funny thing to watch the different levels. I mean, I can find it on YouTube. I'll play it at the end of the show, of them going around the room, letting them vote. The simple yes or no question revealed, it was like you could have had circle time in kindergarten. It wouldn't have been any more, all these people were suddenly 6 or 7 years old.
I think what's important is that we need to become our own healthcare provider. We can't depend on these people. We know that.
No,
and you're right.
They're
going to watch TV and look at these congressmen and say, oh, I want that person to be in charge of my health. Of course not. They're going to pass their laws. There's not a whole lot we can do about that, but we can take care of ourselves.
So how does your book address that aspect of it? Because there's a developmental aspect of BQ and there's a behavioral aspect of BQ that I'm gleaning from everything I've read and seen about you, that – for in a certain extent, you are basically a self-referencing a type of a you know approach to this, where you're not relying on the influence from family, or the influence from culture, or the influence from socioeconomic status. This is everybody's on the same page. Everybody basically is on the ground floor here, and you're building it from the ground up. So you say you're starting out in infancy. We talk about this developmentally in terms of the way the brain will kind of build its social bridges. The first one being mother-child, that's that philosomatic awareness bonding with mommy. And then the second year, the terrible twos, where you break the bond with mom and you go onto and you can become your own boss. And then eco, the third year, where you start, you know, putting the glue in your mouth and sticking your finger in the socket and all that stuff and explore your environment. And then exo, that fourth year, where you start becoming a little bit more like an adult because you can tell past, present, and future, and that memory button comes in, and you can plan, and you can check, and you have systems to doing things. So that whole first 4 years of development is sort of a BQ proving ground, if you will. And, you know, your way of communicating all that comes down to being basically sort of aware of the road you're on, aware of the path is. And then as people get older, like I said, they get invested in their habits, invested in the ways that they carry and communicate themselves, and it becomes more of an unlearning process than it is a proactive learning process. So if you could just have a clear shot at 300 million of us here walking around trying to chew gum, how would you infuse BQ into the culture? Would you emphasize the prenatal early developmental stuff, or would you look at the thing as a continuum?
That's a great question. It would definitely be education, obviously. I think you brought up the prenatal. Obviously, it starts with children. I think it should be part of education. It should be part of pregnancy education, that there's a live being in there. And for 9 months, we take on everything. We feel everything. I do prenatal work, actually, with clients, and people feel, you know. You're a little embryo, and you're a little baby, and you're in your mom's belly, and when she's angry, you feel anger. So it starts with that education. Then, of course, we need to educate in our school systems because, like you said, we're learning push-ups, we're learning how to climb a rope, we're learning how to play a competitive sport. All good. But we could also teach them how to breathe and how to have stress management techniques and how to deal with anxiety, how to communicate. In my book, I have communication skills in there that are body-centered where people communicate from their own experience. Hey, honey, when you did that, I noticed I felt that in my chest. Wow, you know, when you gave me that assignment, I noticed I got excited. That you can actually tune into your body and express it to another person. So that would be a whole new society if we were actually walking around with awareness of our breath, awareness of how we speak to each other, and mostly how we speak to ourselves. Oh, that pain in my neck, that darn hip of mine, that limp leg. Those kind of things send a message through the brain to the body, and the body feels it and develops that. I had a guy tell me that he had the worst pain, actually a chiropractor, the worst pain in the back of his neck for 6 years. And when I had my hands back there and we were breathing and so forth, what came up for him is that 6 years ago he stopped paying his taxes to the IRS. And, basically he would say to himself, I'm going to put that in the back of my neck. I'm just going to put that in the back of my head. I'm sorry. I'm going to just throw that in the back of my head and think about that another time. And what happened is that statement that he kept making threw energy and pain back to his neck and into his brain. And I had him clear it up with the IRS. I said, it's going to cost some money, but you're not going to go to jail. Just work out a payment plan and clear it up. And he did, and the result. The pain went away.
Yeah, and you probably got more business from local CPAs as a result. there's a zillion examples like that. I always say, there's that line from American Beauty where they say, never underestimate the power of denial, which a lot of the stuff in the BQ universe, it deals with addiction. It deals with attachment. It deals with people getting stuck, literally physically stuck, in ways that they aren't aware of. And it could be something as simple as their listening posture. Sometimes I'll just play something for somebody on the computer here, and it could be Swahili. It doesn't matter. I just notice how they hold themselves when they're truly listening to something. And that alone tells you, are they centered? Are they balanced? Are they leaning in? Are they leaning back? Are they tilting their head? Or read something, like especially with kids around 10, 12, 15 years old, their reading habits, they'll read like a cyclops. They'll tilt their head to one side. You see people on the train all the time reading with their head tilted. They'll tilt the page all over the place. Those are physical sort of manifestations of the things you're talking about that can be, if you see yourself or you can sense yourself, better said, you can start to get more functional symmetry. You can start to generate more of this intelligence, and then you can communicate it to other people. So rather than focus on the conflict, you shift the focus to the context. So get into some relationship stuff. Now, out here in New York, I don't know if you guys are following it too much on the West Coast, a little guy called Alex Rodriguez playing for the Yankees. You might have heard of him. And he's had some struggles in the last couple of years with a multitude of things. But for the most part, it's this little month called October that's always been his bugaboo. He can't perform in the postseason. He had a pretty good week last week. I'm a Met fan, so I'm a little bitter about this. But he's been seeing Kate Hudson. I don't know if you follow the celebrity couples, but all of a sudden, this woman has become the MVP of the Yankees, because as a result of this relationship, they think A-Rod is performing well in the field because he now finally has a stable relationship off the field. So how does BQ show up in intimate relationships, family relationships, work relationships, and how can we support it and expand it?
Well, the biggest problem with relationships is that we make assumptions. We assume that the other person is thinking that. We assume they're going to react that way. The assumptions are the problems. Like I said, fact or fiction. Most of our communication in relationships, a lot of it is fiction. It's not true. It's what we think because of our past relationships. Maybe someone didn't like something about us, so we assume another person's not going to like that about us. So assumptions is really the problem. What happens in my teaching is that you get to actually go into your self-evident truth and share it with another person. You get much more intimate. I had a guy who, he had a beer like once a week. I don't think it's a problem to have an alcoholic drink once a week with the guys and come home. But what would happen that once a week is he would get into bed and go to kiss his wife as she was laying there sleeping, and she would freak out. And he's like, man, what's wrong with that? I only had one beer. And she couldn't figure it out either. So as I had her breathe and feel into her body memory, she actually got in touch with a memory, which said, wow, when I was young, my dad used to come back from the bar, and I don't think he did nice things to me while I was laying in bed. Now there's awareness. Now there's truth on the table. No longer are they assuming he's drinking too much, and he's not assuming, oh, she's just freaking out over one beer. Now they've got some fact. And what happened is they cried and they hugged and they realized, now we know the truth. Now we can deal with it. He can brush his teeth or not have a beer. He can not come kiss his wife the night he has a beer. In other words, if you understand people you're in a relationship with, how it triggers them. If you had an older brother that hit you on the shoulder and you constantly reacted and got scared of it, if I put my hand on your shoulder and you go, "Ooh," I'm not going to think, "Wow, you're crazy." I'm going to go, "Hey, I know what's going on. You think I'm your older brother." We have a little more intimacy when we understand each other's body patterns and traumas that are held in their body.
Mm, yeah, and again, when you're in a relationship, you have an independent past that meets in the present, and then you're supposed to be able, from that union, design a coupled future. And if you don't understand that you started out different and you became similar and ultimately are striving to become one, that juggling act gets lost if you exclude the body. If it's just simply belief systems, you know, the tag on the show is Beyond the BS, Beyond the Belief System, to get people to understand that their beliefs are filters, and you can't do much about the filters, but what you can do is be aware of what's going through them and be able to communicate about what you're experiencing from the inside out rather than from the top down with the head there. And I think that's a lot of the conflict that we see, and the drama and the karma and all that stuff that goes on in Hollywood, that you're much more familiar with than I am out here in New York. They just film the movies here. You guys live the movies out there. I think it's become part of American culture in a very kind of exaggerated way. You know, American Idol, people getting on TMZ. We live in a much, much more visual and disassociated world than we did 25 years ago and a generation ago. So what do you say about that? Kids growing up now, coming into their middle of their adolescence, has the YouTube generation generated less BQ, or has it made BQ more of an asset or more of a requirement in order to function in it?
Well, I think there's a lot less BQ out there now because, like I said, we're not realizing, if we're staring at a screen all day, we don't realize we're squeezing our mouth. We don't realize we're pounding the keys. We're on the telephone, and then driving, we're on, you know, people are texting while they're driving. No, they're not aware of what's happening. They're not aware that they're gripping the wheel. They're not aware that they're not looking at the road. They're not aware of a lot of stuff. And I say
so
they, including
land,
me, I can go unconscious as well.
Yeah.
It just happens.
We're almost in zombie land like the movie.
No, I think what's important is for us to stay balanced and to use technology in a way that we can learn and we can grow, we can connect with other people. Hey, to go online and get on the internet and get information quickly, you can order my book online. Boom,
right.
You can have it mailed to you. You can order Kindle and have it delivered to you in an hour, 5 minutes, 3 minutes. I understand. I mean, those things are convenient. It's just a matter of being balanced. We absolutely. I'm not one that's going to put down technology or put down what's going on in the world because, you know, we all use it. I use it too. We're talking on the phone right now.
Yeah.
But I think it's important that we balance it out with breath, movement, exercise, and most of all, not to hold in what you're feeling. If you have an expression, to be able to breathe it out, shout it out, kick it in the pool, you know, hit a baseball, talk to somebody, get it out of your body, not to hold it in, because when we're looking at those screens and that technology, we don't realize how much tension is being built up that we're unaware of.
Mm-hmm. And again, if anyone tuned in late, you could check out Steve's book at onedream.com, and give us the full title of your book, because it's a question with an answer. I love the way you framed it.
Well, it's called What's Your Body Telling You? Because that's a question I've probably asked about 10,000 times in my practice. Oh, I got this problem. I got that problem. Well, what's your body telling you? Get them out of their mind. What's your body telling you? Listening to your body signals to stop anxiety, erase self-doubt, and achieve true wellness.
That's
you can get it on
there.
Anywhere.
Are you dropping off a copy of that on Obama's doorstep? I mean, is he aware that your subterfuge and your insolence is you know, raining on the countryside right now? Because what this does, what a book like that does, and what a question like that does, is it puts people back in the driver's seat. It puts people back in the only conversation that they have full dominion over is the one with themselves. So when you ask them a question like that, they become the interpreter, not the doctor or the insurance company or all the layers of people that are examining them from the outside, probing them, putting them into, you know, I always say piss and blood, you know. You're not your piss and blood. You know, this is getting a little to the point now where we're almost becoming mechanistic to the point of dehumanizing the whole system and devitalizing the whole process of becoming healthy. What's the use if I'm just going to be measured all the time and put on some chart and tracked like some type of, you know, animal or wild kingdom? This is a question you could ask yourself in any moment, in any situation, your entire life. What's my body telling me? I have it actually
exactly
on my shoulder right there. And it made the whiteboard here in some space. So when I see a book title like that, I go, I saw another one the other day, Exploiting Chaos. Like, that one made the board. And the upshot of it is, and again, this is some of the things that then we're going to kind of turn the tables on you here a little bit, because there's a bunch of people like myself and others that are in this somaverse, and we're trying to get people to pay attention to something it's vanilla. It's there all the time. It's sort of croutons. It's the parsley on the plate at the diner. It's sort of an afterthought unless it gets upset, unless it goes into this, you know, red-hot, you know, crisis mode. It doesn't really have a lot of, you know, dramatic information for you. It's sort of the navigator. It sort of steadies the ship, and it allows you to absorb a lot of the bumps in the road because it's been there before. Now, your body's eons old, so it doesn't, if you're late for work, you know, that's a little different than being chased by, like, a tiger in the Serengeti. It's a little different animal, right? You're a little different in the situation. So how do you get people that have gone through, and there's not that many of us out there, actually, that have gone through the indoctrination and gone through the process of becoming to the point where they can deliver this BQ to others, how do they get something that's essentially nonverbal, essentially internal, essentially not even conscious, into a message that they can put into words that others are going to grab onto? You've done it with your book and your work. How did you make the transition from getting it to giving it?
That's a good question. Well, I think the first thing is, you know, getting it or getting in touch with your body doesn't have to be a trauma. It doesn't have to be a big problem. I think a lot of people are learning more about, you know, intelligence. They're learning, like, gee, people are calling it the mobile brain. Deepak Chopra calls it the mobile brain. Dr. Gershon works on the gut and the gut brain, talks about how we have gut instincts that we don't listen to. There's been science on heart transplants where the recipient
right.
of the heart takes on feelings and behaviors of the dead person who had the heart. So there's more and more news out there that, maybe we are more than a mind. Maybe we do have intelligence in every cell. And there's movies and books and a lot of other things coming out that are, you know, promoting that. So as a result, I just feel like, you know, people are going to either, you know, notice, like, I keep making the wrong mistakes, I keep having bad behaviors, I keep doing the wrong thing over and over. And as a result, they'll come to me, for instance, and I'll talk to them. I've worked with rock stars, politicians, all kinds of people, writer's block, film directors that have blocks. We all get it. It happens. And I always ask them that question, take them into their body, and they get a different answer. That's the key. If my mind's not given to me, Albert Einstein says this, a wonderful quote, you can't solve a problem from the same thinking that created it. Think about that. You have a problem, and you think you can get out of it, and you keep thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking, and you're in a spin trap, and you don't get any result. Why not ask your body? Why not take a moment and go, if I stop thinking and I feel into my sensory body, there's intelligence there. Now I see. I'm starting to feel a familiar feeling in my body. A memory's coming back. Oh, yeah, now I see why when he said that, I got worried. Now I see why she said, let's invest in that, and I got scared. Some past experience that my body's still holding on to. Well, now we're into a whole different kind of intelligence. We're not trying to think our way out of it. We're actually feeling and getting information that can take us maybe down a better road the next time.
And again, this is one of those things where this is that dichotomy we have to kind of sew up again. There's that social external eye that, you know, whatever it is, when you're playing that role in your life out there and you're trying to perform in that role and you're feeling self-conscious, you know, read awkward, as opposed to when you're in the me, which is the biological me, which doesn't sign all these social contracts. It just lives its 80, 85 years, hopefully, healthily, and you know, dust to dust. And so it doesn't have near the investment in the outcome. It's much more oriented to the process. Everything to the me in you, the biological part of you, is invested in experience. So it doesn't really care about, you know, if the experience works out or not. Like I said, survival has no style points. But evolution and transcendence is a coupling of the I and the me, and it's exactly what you just said there, where someone's dealing with a social role, like you say, a director dealing with writer's block or something like that, they've got a social issue. They've got a challenge out there that's putting pressure on them, and they go in their head. And there's no answers in their head because their head signed the deal. It said, perform to this level that we're going to set outside of you, and you're going to meet this bar, or you're not going to get the little cheese here at the end of the little maze you're going to go through, right? And people will do this. This is the rat race 101. What they forget is if they bring their body along, bring their awareness along, that has absolutely no investment in the outcome, but enjoys the process. I mean, when you were a kid, making a snowman or doing, you weren't trying to make the perfect snowman. You were just happy to roll the ball of snow, and it was like the standards were much, much more, you know, on an experiential level. And we've made everything about results in this culture. Almost everything in every industry is a results-oriented business. How do we get the practitioners, the people that are delivering the BQ, who have to get them, you know, their clients well? I mean, this is, again, another carrot out there. I've basically gotten out of the health and disease model completely. I just deal with vitality now because I think health and disease are just like we talk about in relationships. They're just stories. They're just rumors and stories, a lot of them full of misinformation. And when you could look at someone and see if their vitality is up or down, if they're devitalized, if they're dispirited, how do we get people that are delivering this work to get back into the process, experiential, you know, outcome be damned orientation? Because they are trying to make a living too, doing whatever they're doing. If they're doing, you know, body work or they're doing the coaching, or and I just see everybody's out there looking for the carrot and they're getting the stick.
Yeah, I work with a lot of practitioners. I actually work with a ton of holistic practitioners, a lot of chiropractors, body workers, massage people, cranial therapy, you name it, acupuncturists. You know, because absolutely these are a great deliverers of healing that want to learn more about body, whole body consciousness, how to help people with emotional problems. You know, even when you're working on a body, I've taught at massage schools, and I'm speaking at the wellness conference in Connecticut. I think it's November 20th.
I'm trying to meet you there, actually.
That's right, because this is really where people have an opportunity to learn more that, hey, when somebody's on your table and you're touching them, there you may be touching a memory. You may bring up something. And that happens a lot for people in the field, you know, whether they're giving an adjustment or they're giving a, you know, massage or an acupuncture treatment, somebody will start crying. They'll go, whoa, you know, what's that? So I help them, first of all, as a practitioner, you want to be breathing when you're working with someone, and you want to be aware of your own body as you're working with somebody. A lot of people are teachers, gurus. They go out there and they teach, but are they breathing? Are they in their own body? Are they actually noticing? I call it the loop of awareness. So when I work with a client, I'm also noticing, oh, as that person is crying or as that person has tension in their belly, I just noticed I wasn't breathing, or I breathe and notice what my body's feeling. That's more of a symbiotic relationship. I think it'd be, you know, it's really the healing of the future, if you will, where it's an interactive relationship between the healer and the client.
But why don't you give us some examples of people that we see in the culture every day, people that you consider high BQ people. My big example for people lately, because I just saw him, was Springsteen. I've never seen a guy, he's 60 now, I don't know if he's 60 exactly, jump around that stage, you know, for 3.5 hours and engage 50,000 people as if he was playing right to you. So who do you know, that you could give an example of people that exude this high BQ
sure.
that people can use as a model?
Yeah, well, like you said, you know, in any performer who's using their whole body, now they may come off the stage and, you know, shut down. Who knows? But at least in that moment when you're doing something you love and you're passionate. And I tell you, I just think watching Barack Obama, I think Obama has a lot that you can notice when you saw all the presidential primaries and the debates. You just notice the different candidates, the low BQ and the high BQ. I don't even need to mention the low BQs, but the people who were just shouting and saying things and their bodies were giving off, you know, angry messages.
You mean watching that John McCain's, like, face turn beet red, like things like that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they pick up on it. But notice Obama, and I read in the Wall Street Journal once where Michelle Obama actually said in the first debate that Barack had with Hillary Clinton, she said, get into your body, you know, get into your emotions. You're too in your head. So, of course, I use that. I'm pretty sure I use that in my book. But I think it's great that that was said because, you know, he is somebody who has charisma and actually whatever his deal is, and of course I would love to reach him. Notice that even though when it's people are calling him names and saying the worst thing, he doesn't lose his cool. And of course, athletes. I mean, so many athletes have a high BQ in the way that they can see something and notice and move. But really, what we're speaking about is it could be anyone that's just in their body, meaning when there's a choice. I call it a choice point. In every moment, there's a choice point. Whether it's making an investment, whether it's saying hello, whether it's how you're going to walk down the street, whether it's making a business decision, there's always a choice. And in that moment, you have a choice to be in your body or out, meaning you're so in your head that you have no idea what's going on in your body, or all you need to do is what we've been talking about tonight, ask, oh, well, what's my body tell me? Oh, it's tight. Oh, I notice I'm happy. I notice my heart's beating fast. Just to be more aware that you are in a body, and the more you're in touch with it, the better your decisions will be, the more confident you'll be in your decision-making, and you'll be able to, you know, whether you're in business or relationship, you'll have more confidence about yourself. I call it your mojo, you know, your charisma. Your mojo is going to be higher. You're going to attract people, and you're going to be attractive because you're breathing and you're feeling and you're alive. Like you got excited by seeing how Springsteen was connecting and moving in his body. We all have that. We all have a billboard, and we all display through our body what we're feeling.
And again, this is one of those things, you know, we talk about a sense of coherence, which is Anton Ivosky's work, which is he studied people that were coming out of like earthquakes and, you know, floods, and who was resilient and who was in the corner, you know, curled up in a ball. And why did that person become resilient in that situation? Why did that person curl up on the ball? And he boiled it down to three things. The sense of coherence is the ability to have a life that's you can manage, you can comprehend, and has meaning. And a lot of people that have the low BQ, their life is meaning less, not meaning more, because you're not impacting other people. So the sort of the little tag I give, a little somatic tag I give, especially with people with certain brain designs, is that when you leave the company of somebody else, it could be someone you hit every day or someone you just see once in a while at the gas station, whatever, do you feel more energy when you part company with them, or do you feel a little bit like you just got like a chunk taken out of you? And there's energy vampires out there that'll just kind of drain you. They're not conscious they're doing it. They're just exuding that low BQ, and you get into your head because they're in their head. And if you've ever been in one of those intellectual tug-of-wars, and I've been to conferences with a lot of people with letters after their names, and they're telling me all this information, which might be good, probably better to read it than to hear it, and I'll just tap them on the shoulder, and I'll just say, do you have it on a website or a PDF? Because I've got to get out of here. So how do you, once you're aware of this stuff, how do you share it with others in a way that is empowering to them and supportive for yourself? Because I see a lot of people become awakened into this awareness, and they become uber sensitive. They can't be around any people. They can't hear. They can't deal with any music in the dentist's office anymore. And they become almost sensory averse.
Well, I think the key is to just, again, know that you have a choice and that it's so important. I mean, I know for me, if I don't get up and do some kind of daily ritual, which is breathing, moving, praying, and touching in with my life's purpose, you know, stretching, gratefulness, whatever you work into, appreciation, the day goes a whole different tone. I set a tone for my life or a day by how much I breathe, how much I relax my body, how much I open my body. I think a lot of people into exercise, again, when you're exercising at the gym, don't be gritting your teeth. Notice if you're doing it like, I hate this and I've got to do it. I've got to make my arms bigger. You know, do it in a way where it can be with grace, and you can be breathing, and you can be feeling, and you can be a manager of a big company. You can be, you know, working at a factory. You can be an employee. You can be working. It's so important to notice if you're at the computer all day as a receptionist or as somebody working in, you know, research, to just notice, am I gripping the mouse? Am I staring, you know, am I leaning over? Am I slumping over my, you know, keyboard? I think it's really important for us to wake up and be more aware of, you know, what our body's telling us in the moment. And it will, I promise, it'll help our health, because we'll have less tension, less arthritis, less stress, and less things being held in the body, and we'll be able to breathe and have more circulation going. We'll be more alive.
Well, less self-induced trauma anyway, because there's enough that's induced from life itself. But I actually found this little committee thing. I'm going to see if it'll play for us here. We can listen to the grunts of the yeses here.
Second, the recorded post is
hilarious.
Automatic. Rockefeller, roll.
Mr. Rockefeller.
Aye.
Mr. Rockefeller, aye. Mr. Conrad.
Aye.
Mr. Conrad, aye. Mr. Bingaman.
Aye.
Mr. Bingaman, aye. Mr. Carey.
Aye.
Mr. Carey, aye. Mrs. Lincoln.
Aye.
Mrs. Lincoln, aye. Mr. Wyden.
Aye.
Mr. Wyden, aye. Mr. Schumer.
Aye.
Mr. Schumer, aye. Ms. Stabenow.
Aye.
Ms. Stabenow, aye. Ms. Cantwell.
Aye.
Ms. Cantwell, aye. Mr. Nelson.
Aye.
Mr. Nelson, aye. Mr. Menendez.
Aye.
Mr. Menendez, aye. Mr. Carper.
Aye.
Mr. Carper, aye. Mr. Grassley.
No.
Mr. Grassley, no. Mr. Hatch.
No.
Mr. Hatch, no. Ms. Snow. Ms. Snow, aye. Mr. Kyle.
No.
Mr. Kyle, no. Mr. Bunning. Mr. Bunning, no. Mr. Crapo. Mr. Crapo, no. Mr. Roberts. Mr. Roberts, no. Mr. Ensign. Mr. Ensign, no. Mr. Enzi. Mr. Enzi, no. Mr. Cornyn. Mr. Cornyn, no. Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
Chairman votes aye.
Classic.
Kirk, will tell you the
vote. Yeah, we know. It's 14-9. Okay. It's, some of the people that said no just mouthed the word no. That was classic. And then a couple of them blurted out,
yeah.
It was just, if you want a somatic 101 lesson in congruency, just play that clip on YouTube and you'll get some an education there. It was the Senate Finance Committee chiming in on yesterday's vote to move the Baucus bill to the main floor of the Senate. So the process is educational on two levels. You learn how your government works and you learn how your government sits, I guess, at the same time. So, Steve, still there? Hello?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. I thought I lost you there in a second.
Listening.
Okay. What did you think of that, by the way? To me, that was just a minute of somatic, like, discourse that you can't, the gritting of the teeth and the gnashing of the hands, you can't appreciate it here on the radio, but you watch it on YouTube.
Oh, yeah, no, I could even hear it in the voice. I
could
hear
you could sense it.
And
yeah, I knew you could sense it.
Fixable.
I mean,
it's
really
fixable.
Sad how all these politicians have been basically put into some type of social experiment where they're, I mean, you probably aware, you know, the town hall meetings over the summer, how vitriolic they got. When people are dealing with something as visceral as this, that's dealing with fear and death and protection and all these big fish things, these big caveman items, I call them, can BQ become a little bit scary to have at that point where you just want to run your head and have the cognitive shield up and just go into your belief systems and be Dorothy in the castle there after the monkeys got her?
Well, of course. Of course. I think it's most people, of course, who wants to feel anything uncomfortable. Sometimes if you start to actually feel and you're not numb, then you might have to go through that fear or that anger or that sadness. And I understand. Who wants to feel those, you know? At the same time, we know, at least from the somatic world and from the emotional world and from people expressing, when you get it off your chest, you feel better. I had a woman who had asthma, and she couldn't breathe very well. And as she started to really breathe with me and go into her body, and I was holding and had her put her finger exactly where she felt the tightest part of her chest when she was breathing, she realized she was holding on to something there for 30 years. 30 years ago, she was told she had asthma. And what it was her grandfather died. It was her best friend, her buddy, and she was so upset. And when she went to scream at God and cry, her parents told her, no, he's happy in heaven. Don't cry. Don't scream. Nope, hold it in. Take it in. So she held it in. Then she went to a funeral, and she just was so upset. And they went, no. Grandpa's in heaven. Don't look upset. So she wasn't allowed to feel. And she held it in, and about a day later, they took her to the doctor, and she was told she had asthma. And
right.
She's been sucking that inhaler since. So once she got to express with me how she felt, I'm angry, I miss my grandpa,
yeah,
all that stuff, it opened and she got it off her chest. She was breathing much better after one session. Again, I'm not a doctor. I'm just saying that it's important for us not to hold stuff in our body. It's much better to release it. Yet it's scary. You're right. It's scary to go there sometimes. And every one of us have a choice.
Well, I am a doctor, and I my problems with people is they think negative emotions are invalid. And they will do all kinds of gymnastics to tell me that, you know, it's never necessary to be angry or fearful or doubtful. And I'm like, really? How long have you been on this planet?
Because well, that's because they're calling them negative.
First of all, you labeled them negative. Of course they're going to be something you don't want. They're just protective emotions. Some emotions are supportive and some emotions are protective. When they're protecting you, it's now degree and extent. Are they overprotecting you and choking you? Or are they protecting you because your body feels concerned that there's a threat or there's something I need to express? And if you push that down, you're basically denying the intelligence of that affect, and your system is way too versed in subterfuge to let you get away with that. Like I said, enjoy your asthma. Enjoy your migraine. Whatever the symptom is, and this is one of those things that I think a lot of your work would lend credence to, is that the concept of the symptom path to enlightenment, to allow yourself to experience a symptom for what it's worth, and don't make it into some big grandiose thing like what's going on with these flu symptoms, where everyone that coughs and sneezes is jumping into a laundry bin to hide from everybody, because they're like the beer pong thing up in New York State there. Everyone's afraid of the boogeyman, and now we have a nice big boogeyman called the H1N1, I call it, H1N1 virus, that just like all the other ones they've trotted out there in the last decade, whether they would be SARS or Western Nile or Ebola, they happen out there to other people, and it's coming for you, and it's like the only line of protection, of course, is Big Pharma. All of those moves, to me, take BQ off the radar. We have absolutely no use for BQ here because our body's stupid, susceptible, vulnerable, and now we've frightened you and put you into a position where you have no authority. So how would you approach the flu season from a BQ perspective to get people to understand that they have resources within that are natural, free, and engaging with them right now?
I think it's important that people tune into their body. If somebody tunes into their body and they're clear that they need to get the flu shot in order to relax, you know, that's up to them. I mean, each person has to make their choice. You know, I was on Montel Williams' radio show last week, and Montel had a segment right before me which said there was mercury in the flu vaccination. And, you know, some people are out there saying, hey, it's not good for you, it's bad for you. So, you know, you really have to check into your own body and decide, you know, do I want something like this? Am I afraid? Is that the only way I can get through that fear to get a shot? Am I doing it because my boss told me to? Am I doing it because, you know, my spouse said you have to? I think each person has to decide, listen to your body and find out what it is. And you're right. I mean, a lot of the germs, a lot of the stuff is external, or it's put in the air, it's in our water, it's in various things. And each of us just have to make that choice. I feel like having the high BQ boosts your immune system, keeps you flowing, keeps the energy flowing in your body, and you're less susceptible to catch diseases.
Yeah, and the less of a polarity you have with your surroundings, because if you have good kinesthetic intelligence, good, you know, flowing awareness, as you call it, the environment is not your enemy. The environment is the medium that you express yourself through, so you don't feel like the boogeyman's out there. This is just an extension of me, fish and water, humans and you know, walking around on the planet. And you don't feel this need to sort of bolster yourself against a likelihood or unlikelihood of exposure to whatever microbes out there, because they're going, I ask little kids this all the time, what do you think the little flu bug feels like? Everybody's got, you know, it's like going into a town and you haven't been to this town before, it's got 50 trillion cells, you want to visit somebody, everybody's zipping up and, you know, putting up their no vacancy sign, and you become a little desperate. You kind of, you know, it's almost like you make the potential for the illness more likely by having this massive cultural fire drill every fall. I mean, they literally bust the seniors to the local drugstores here, and of course New York State, being a lead dog and all this, they're mandating the healthcare workers get it against their will. So whether it's dealing with we talked about childbirth or a teenager, you know, making a decision about having a pregnancy go through, having an abortion or not, all the surgical decisions you make when you sign off on stuff, these are all moments of truth for someone that's developing their BQ to honor their body. And again, I always think at the end of life, too, there's a certain amount of dignity that goes with this, too, to let your body know that your body's going to die. And it's like, this is another thing we go through, extending life way past where there's a quality of life for that person. And we'll drug them and put them in nursing homes just to keep them alive, but they're really not there anymore. So I guess in closing, just to kind of wrap things up, what's the biggest misconception about BQ as it relates to not just life, we talked about that for the whole show, but death and dying, and how can we honor ourselves in a BQ way when we come to that moment of life? Not the death panels, but dealing with life as a process, and death as part of that process.
I think it's important to, at any stage like that, to acknowledge and learn to love your body, appreciate all that it's done for you, feel what you need to feel, allow emotions to be expressed. You're crossing over into whatever you believe in, the next life, heaven, etc. Then it's important to be conscious. It's be important to not just be numbed out, but to actually feel and express to the people you love, express to your creator or your spirit. I think it's a really important now and up to the day we die to be able to know that we are in a body. We're more than a body, but we do live in a body. And that be able to be one with it and appreciate it and feel it, and of course feel our heart. I mean, the main thing is that we have a heart. We have love, and I think it's important for people to be able to feel and express their heart and their heart energy wherever they are.
All right, Steve. Well, thanks for joining us tonight. Again, the book is available now on Amazon. It's What's Your Body Telling You? This fascinating world of BQ. I'm glad to be somewhere on the bus. Looking out the window as you're driving it, and hopefully we'll cross paths up there in Connecticut. Great stuff.
Yeah, I'll see you at the Wellness Expo, and check out. I give a free BQ test and a free guided journey to life's purpose on One Dream. That's onedream.com. And good luck with your show.
All right, man. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight. Great information, great stuff, and love the book.
Thank you, Dr. Mark. Appreciate it.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
All right, and there goes Steve. So there'll be no sweat lodge in Connecticut, as it were. So there you go. That's the world of BQ and the world of Steve Siskold. And just, like I said, I wanted to take a break from all this boo-hoo stuff about this damn flu. Anyway, that's the show for this week. Again, I wanted to go back just to one point before we pedal out of here, and that's when it comes to making decisions. A lot of the stuff that goes into decision making, you talked about the Einstein quote, which has been basically, I think it's a little sore, it's been worn out, but you're stuck, you're trying to make a decision, what do I do, and people run in their heads and they go all crazy. I'm guilty of it, believe me, this ego can spin his brain. But when you get quiet, and you get still, and you close your eyes and find your feet, and you become somatically aware, which you can begin doing right now at somaspace.org. As you click on the little four domains thing, it takes you away to my little book, The S-List, which gives you all kinds of details about brain design and how you can get your body in the rhythms. So, back to decision-making. When you're faced with these choice points, whether it's with you or a relationship or a career or anything you're dealing with, when you engage your body in it, don't try to think about what to do. Put yourself in the feeling of what it's like to be beyond the problem. What is it going to feel like 10 years from now after this has been solved and is over with? And your system, because it has the ability to dial into future patterns, will deliver you a feeling, an affect. And then from that feeling, you'll get two things. You'll get an activity. You'll feel, okay, I got to move, or I got to stay still. Something as simple as that. And then from there, you'll get the pictures. And the pictures might show up in a dream. They might show up as a bunch of license plates. But your awareness is turned on 360 degrees. So when you're pressed to make a decision, even when it's something that has to be done in the moment, time crunch, close your eyes, find your feet, and sense your body. And then it goes from there. And the rest of the stuff gets even simpler. And to all my friends down in Washington, I just wish you luck with this dopey bill.
You filthy criminals.
That's right. And just to close out, I have a review. Actually, I have a couple things to play. First, I have a little clip from Michael Moore's movie Sicko. Not the new one. This is the last one. that really kind of sums up what we put ourselves through for the last generation or two, that I really think as we move into this new healthcare reform, if we ever get there, you might want to think about this, because I had a guest on the show a long time ago, Canadian woman, and I asked her what's the biggest sort of hidden story behind mental illness, and I said, you know, what is it? And she said poverty, and I kind of stared at the phone. I went, well, poverty, and just listen to this little clip from Michael Moore's movie Sicko, and then I'll play you something else.
And hope for the best is what we do, right from the moment we're born. We've got the worst infant mortality rate in the Western world. A baby born in El Salvador has a better chance of surviving than a baby born in Detroit. But it gets better when we go to school.
Classrooms with 40 students, schools with no science labs.
No wonder the majority of our young adults can't find Britain on the map. But that's okay, there's always college. And by the time we graduate, our ass is so unhocked we're deep in debt before we even have our first job.
I'm at about, we'll say about $35,000 in debt. And that's for my third year in college.
That way you'll be the kind of employee they're looking for. One who needs this job.
3,904, 3,905.
And what employer wouldn't want to employ someone thousands of dollars in debt? Because they won't cause any trouble. In addition to having to pay off your college debt, you need a job with health insurance. It would be horrible to lose that kind of job, wouldn't it?
You can always quit, you know. There's no law that says you have to work here.
And if that one job doesn't pay all the bills, don't worry. You can get another one. And another one. And another one.
I work three jobs, and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
You're uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic that you're doing that. Get any sleep?
And if you're not getting enough sleep, take pharmaceuticals.
You're tired all the time. You may feel sad, hopeless.
If you suffer from excessive worry,
you could be suffering from generalized anxiety disorder.
It could be adult ADD.
Talk to your doctor.
Ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor.
Yes, ask your doctor and ask him for more drugs. That should keep you pretty doped up until it's time to retire. Did I say retire? Well, if you do make it to 80, I'm sure your pension will still be there. Unlike the new employees for these companies who will never see a pension. Don't worry, I'm sure our kids will take care of us, considering the great life we've given them. Oh, and remember, let's defeat the terrorists over there, so we don't have to fight them here.
All right, so there's a little Michael Moore from the movie Sicko. Now, I'm going to play this clip for you here. This is a long-time client here of mine, through many incarnations, all the way back to Mill Square Chiropractic, actually. Actually, he goes actually back to my original office in White Plains. So, you know, one from the Pine Barrens. And he saw the new movie and left me a voicemail that could be a little eerie. But take a listen to our eco friend.
I don't know if you've got this, if you're getting this message. I mean, it's being buzzed out pretty quick. I just took two Vicodin, and I'm about to embark on a couple of martinis. What I saw today in the movie theater was nothing more than every horror that I've felt for the last 20 years when a priest friend of mine, who reminds me of you, told me to go see this guy when he made Roger and me. I cried my balls off my body today. I never, ever in my life had seen everything so real. And I thank God that it actually was shown. And you know what? I sat in an auditorium with blue heads. Out of 45 people, five of us didn't come in with walkers. And they all gave a round of applause. Even the fucking geezers know they get fucked. Fuck you, son.
There's a little BQ for you, East Coast style there, Steve. You're still out there. Holy mackerel. So there you go. So there's someone that sees the movie Capitalism and has an experience that was worthy of that voicemail. What does that say about the relationship between the culture that we live in and the physiology that we experience? We can't separate ourselves. The society is the thing that's neurotic, not us. We're in a neurotic society, a drug culture that is basically designed, as we've seen guest after guest come on here, to extract a lot of value from us as individuals and, you know, basically turn us into mini corporations. We've had, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk on here. We've had Dave Malicki on here. We have all these guys that talk about personal branding. Maybe we'll have a couple more guests on that talk about this stuff. Every single time I hear it, every single time I read about it, I get a little wistful because it just means that the game keeps becoming more about dividing and conquering and not helping us be able to join and cooperate. Because if you do lower your guard in a world like this, you see the way the game is played. So hopefully, like I said, there's been a war on everything else. I'd rather, instead of having a war on poverty, another dopey war we're never going to try and solve because there's too many people invested in it, is to take a little more look at how we can simplify our lives so that we're not chasing these carrots. Like I said during the show, it's a result-oriented culture. It's a performance-based culture. And we will drug ourselves. We will work ourselves into a frenzy. We will behave ourselves into addictions. And we will burn ourselves out pursuing those carrots. And a lot of times, like I said, it isn't through any fault of our own to strive for these things. The issue is, are we doing it with all of our faculties? And we talked about BQ tonight. You can go check out my site at somaspace.org for more information about how to develop your somatic awareness and be able to understand your primary domain, which is what is running your show most of the time. How your brain develops is how your body will respond, and that's what we're trying to get across to here on the show every week on Soma Time. Next week, oh boy, we've got a woman that wrote a book about worrying, as if we needed more of that, but she talked about something called smart worrying. That's Dr. Beverly Potter. She'll be on next week with us. So until then, everybody here, everybody there, everybody in between, this is Dr. Mark. He's got to blow his nose on Soma Time. And let's see. I think I'll take us a little out. Let's see. I'm looking for a nice song. Oh, yeah. All right, a little Brucella. Take us out here on a Wednesday night here in Oinktober. Don't get your freaking flu shot. How many times I got to tell you? I don't care if you're afraid. Don't listen to Steve. Run away. Run away. Seasonal, swine, whatever other version, Fruit Loop flu, whatever they make up. Listen to Bruce, will you? Beyond the BS. That's it. Maybe the Bruce flu. Get that. Yankees got penna fever. Bastards. All right, guys. We'll see you next week. Travel light through the darkness. Be well. The man stand over dead dog while highway in the ditch. He's looking down kind of puzzled, poking that dog with a stick. Got his car door flung open. He's standing out on Highway 31. Like if you stood there long enough, struck me kind of funny, some kind of funny suddenly. Still at the end of every hard day, people find some reason to believe. Now my little love Johnny was a little mean and true. She said, baby, I'll work for you every day, bring my money home with you. One day up and left her, and ever since that, she waits down at the end of that dirt road for young Johnny to come back. Struck me kind of funny, yeah. At the end of every hard-earned day, Spiral on, Sapiens.